Extra. We're now on Radio 4 Extra. More from Michael Palin's diaries recalling the Python years. He began keeping a diary in 1969, and the extracts we've been hearing all this week take us through to 1979. In today's episode, he looks back on a mixed bag of experiences after being invited to appear on TV in the States.
Thursday, March the 9th, 1978. Nancy Lewis, our New York manager, rings in the evening. Evidently, it's the first day of spring in New York and she's in very high spirits. Saturday Night Live, the Chevy Chase late-night programme that swept the US, want me to be a guest host of the show. She puts a little pressure on to get me to do it. I resist, but then Helen shouts from the kitchen that we need the money. Thursday, March the 30th. Over the next 2 days, I must pack in 901 things before leaving for the US on Saturday morning. Nancy has booked me on Concorde, so I'll arrive in New York 2 hours earlier than I left London. I don't really approve, but it's got to be worth the experience. Once. Monday, April the 3rd, New York. At 5, over to NBC in the RCA building at 30 Rockefeller Plaza. Magnificent views. The Empire State Building dominating to the southeast, and to the northeast, the twin Gothic spires of St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, guarded by sweeping skyscraper blocks on all sides. A classic New York panorama. Producer Lorne Michaels was not in his office when I arrived. I got to know the room a little first. Along one wall were framed mementos of Saturday Night Live, pictures of the cast meeting President Ford, numerous jokily inscribed photos from Chevy Chase, letters from the White House, Emmy Awards. On the facing wall, two wood-framed cabinets full of video cassettes of the shows labelled according to their host: Steve Martin, Anthony Perkins, Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Eric Idle, O.J. Simpson, Kris Kristofferson, Paul Simon, Art Garfunkel, and so on. Lorne ambled in, small, unremarkably dressed, with a bright, intelligent face and disproportionately large head. An attractive, easy confidence as he shook hands. A lack of calculated effusiveness, but no lack of warmth in the welcome. I knew I was going to get along with him and felt suitably relieved. There are about 15 writers who assemble in Lorne's office, 5 or 6 of them women. All bar one look younger than me, mainly scruffy, a rather earnest college look about them. The meeting is a curiously stilted affair. No ideas are put forward with great conviction. It's as though this first meeting is part of a formula which has to be gone through. The real ideas will form tomorrow. Lorne invites me to a party to be thrown at the fashionable disco, Studio 54, by Truman Capote and Andy Warhol. As we push in through double doors, I catch sight of the black-cloaked figure of T. Capote. In the bright light, he looks like a mole or a badger, appearing briefly, immaculately, then gone. Inside, the club is like any other heaving mass of bodies. Almost immediately, brush up against Mick and Jerry. Jagger is at his most inelegantly slurry and warns me against the puffs here. Then he's lost, borne away on the crowd. A glorious mixture of people. On one journey through the crowd, I passed comedian Dick Martin and Salvador Dali, not together. The model girl, Brooke Shields, who plays the 12-year-old whore in Louis Malle's shortly-to-open Pretty Baby, was sitting beside us. The party was ostensibly to watch the 50th Academy Awards ceremony, live from LA. They bayed at the awards, especially when Vanessa Redgrave gave her short and rather mistimed speech about anti-Semitism and fascism, and they roared with exultation at the 3 awards for Annie Hall. In the end, the home crowd won. The starched and trim bronzinos of the West Coast were routed by the forces of the East Coast. Mr. Woody Allen, who was at this moment playing clarinet in Michael's pub in Greenwich Village. As Lorne said, Woody always has taste, and not being at the awards demonstrates taste at its highest. The place was filling up, and there was a growing compulsion to decadence. as if it was expected of the audience here to be outrageous, egomanic, wild and uncontrolled. I found it horribly depressing, almost a nightmare, and was relieved when we left just before one. Wednesday, April the 5th, New York. The read-through takes place in the green room on the 9th floor. This is to become one of the landmarks of the building over the next few days. Bowls of salad, coffee and beers are provided, and the room is crammed with 20 or 30 people. My feelings after the read-through were that I was reading an awful lot of narrator linkman parts and would have preferred to have done more characters. The writers sensed and appreciated this and went off to rewrite, whilst myself, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, grim-faced and unshaven, began our first rehearsal for the Shylights dance routine. Lorne loves the Shylights song Have You Seen Her and wants it on the show. Two of the Shylights have been imprisoned and one is dead, but Lorne still has the lead singer and hopes that the rest of us, in Afro wigs, will be able to recreate the group behind him. I'm sceptical. Thursday, April the 6th. I have to do a series of visual promos, which go smoothly, and in their small way give the studio crew confidence in me. That night I eat out with Lorne at Charlie O's. He is inquisitive, but not prying. We talk about marriages, kids, relationships. I like him more and more. It's at 2 in the morning that we stumbled eventually onto what is to become the opening monologue, my own proving piece. I'm to play my manager and come on and apologise for Michael not having arrived. The ideas fall thick and fast, and I suggest that the manager should talk about his other acts, then possibly end on an act of his own. This fits neatly in with an idea of one of the young, new writers, of someone dancing with ferrets down their trousers. I adapt this to dancing to the White Cliffs of Dover whilst putting seafood salad and 2 cats down my trousers. Great is the nocturnal hilarity. I just hope it wears well in the morning. Friday, April the 7th. Now I understand why Python can be so successful in the US. And it is prestigious. It's repeated endlessly. On Mondays on Channel 13 in New York and 5 nights a week in Los Angeles, 5 nights a week in New Orleans, plus numerous other regional showings one hears of. Saturday, April the 8th. Shave, select clothes that will be seen across the nation tonight, and I think that's probably the last time today that I consciously stop and think about the awesome accessibility of TV. The number of homes all over America who will be looking at me tonight, a thought too colossal to comprehend. So I don't. I get going. My philosophy of the day is that this is a cabaret, and the words are all on cue cards anyway. To the studio around lunchtime. Almost the first person I see is John Belushi. He's a regular member of the team and probably the best known now Chevy Chase has left. The audience comes in for a full house dress rehearsal at 7:30. For the first time, I feel nervous. The Shylights dance routine is cut. "You'll thank me in years to come," says Lorne, when I make mild protest. I'm thanking him now. Then comes the moment of truth. For the next 5 or 6 minutes, it's just me. The monologue goes averagely. The show speeds on, no major boobs, but a poor audience. However, I appreciated the psychological boost of a full audience dress rehearsal. Most of the terrors are gone now. From now on, there's no time to think. First, there is a meeting in Lorne's office. Briskly, Lorne runs through the show. 2 sketches disappear altogether. Writers are sent scurrying off to rewrite material. By 10:15, a smart, new, typed running order is issued. Then to the dressing room. A good luck telegram from Terry and Eric reads, "Please stay in America." Then into the wonderful, baggy, shiny grey suit with a specially protective cat lining in front. It could be a Python recording. I feel strangely and completely at home as 11:30 nears. I'm moved into position by Joe Dixo, the dependable, refreshingly unkempt floor manager, and at 11:30, we're off. The cold opening, the big build-up, then titles, my name in lights on an electric billboard in Times Square, oh, Lorne the showman. The cast, and then, in rich, trusty tones, your host for tonight, Michael Palin. A warm reception, The monologue intrigues them, but I can't wait to get to the dance with the cats and the seafood salad. All is going well, but the cats have stage fright, and as I gyrate and at the same time try and coax these pussies into my trousers, I become aware of a frightful smell and a warm brown mess all down my arm. Even as I'm grinning manically and pushing it down, the cat is shitting more violently. I can't hear the audience reaction above the band, but I know the worst is happening. This is going to be tele-embarrassment on a monumental scale. The offending cat leapt away, and I was left stroking the other one's little marmalade head as it peeked out of my trousers. I caught sight of myself on the monitor, and it looked nightmarishly obscene. But the red light of the camera shone unblinkingly at me, revealing to the entire US a man who looked as if he were masturbating with an arm covered in shit. Awful. An awful, monumentally awful moment. No time after it to stop, think, question. I had a one-minute costume change to become a Roman Catholic priest in a confessional. I reached the confessional with 5 seconds to spare, slid back the partition, and suddenly realised my arm was still stained with cat nerves. The stink in the cramped little confessional grew by the minute. Even after the confessional, there was no time for the scrub I needed. I raced the length of the studio, tearing off my soutane as I rocketed through the audience in order to make a change into a very famous actor who was to play a scene from Chekhov whilst escaping from a trunk. Retribution pursued me as I was locked in a trunk with my smell. Half an hour of high-pressure insanity had gone by before I was able to stop and think and gauge reactions to the hideous occurrences during the opening monologue. Lorne, who was on the floor throughout the taping, was the first to try and convince me that the opening had been hilarious, and I realised that nobody knew the hell of embarrassment I'd been through. After all, you can't smell on TV, and the camera was never close on my arm, and anyway, it all looked like seafood salad. No, it was great, they all said. Lorne was cutting and changing and reshaping, even as we were on the air. We lost a sketch around 1 o'clock, and then the farewells and thank yous, and it was all over. Nancy had a huge magnum of champagne ready, many congratulations, but I think mainly just the joy of relief of having done it. Up to Lorne's office to see the tape. It did look monstrously funny. Bill Murray thought it was the best show this year. Everyone very happy. Sunday, April the 9th, New York. At the airport, the check-in girl complimented me on the show, as did a couple of passengers. Unspeakable joy of sinking into an aircraft seat and being served champagne and a meal as I let my mind drift happily over this extraordinary week. I feel very happy and very content. I reflect that I don't really want to do comedy all my life. A commitment to comedy for another 2 or 3 years, and I'd be nearly 40, and too old for the Robert De Niro roles I subconsciously yearn for. My scheme is to retire at 40 and write and travel. Write travel books, but decent, original, bright, funny ones. I'm perfectly well aware that around the borders of my life are problems, difficulties, even human tragedies demanding my involvement. I know I can't live in a continual vacuum of happiness, but a day like today restores energies and rebuilds whatever faith one has. Today there is nothing more I want than what I have.
And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Come on, boy, cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life.
And after that final burst of song, no prizes for guessing what he'll be talking about tomorrow. It is, of course, the making of Life of Brian. Michael Palin was reading his diaries charting the Python years. It was abridged by Loris Morgan Griffiths, and the producer was Louise Armitage. Now, we all know that radio is a powerful and useful medium, but did you know that in Colombia, South America, there are so many kidnappings that the country's biggest radio station has a programme made specifically for the kidnapped? On Sunday, This American Life pays a visit to the show that allows family and friends to communicate with their missing loved ones.
A dozen interns man flashing phone banks, lining up the callers from around the country who will send out their messages tonight.
Ok, listo.
$170 will make it on the air.
Buenos días, mi hermanito. ¿Cómo estás?
This American Life Held Hostage is on BBC Radio 4 Extra Sunday morning at 11 and again in the evening at 7.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
A cloak made from the silk of a million spiders, tunnelling under the Berlin Wall, and The Brave Tin Soldier, read by David Tennant. You'll find it all shoehorned into another packed 4 o'clock show coming up in an hour. Drama first at 3 o'clock, though, and today it's a classic Charles Dickens story, but with a twist. It's all about Martin Chuzzlewit, transported to modern-day India in the Mumbai Chuzzlewits. Told from the point of view of Orphan Thomas, an observer into the world of the Chuzzlewits, this is a fast-paced drama full of intrigue, romance, suspense and murder. And for added radio colour, it was recorded on location in India.
This is Bandra, where I grew up. Back then it was just a fishing village in North Mumbai. A quiet island of churches, cottages and rice plantations. The original community of Catholics that inhabited Bandra were called East Indians, named after the British East India Company. That's what I am, an East Indian. At least that's how I was brought up. I was left on the steps of St. Teresa's orphanage on Turner Road when I was a baby. The nuns named me Thomas. I kept to myself mostly. I'd walk through the narrow alleys of nearby villages, enjoying the smell of bread baking, chasing the scrawny resident chickens, and climbing border trees to eat the fruit from it. It was on one such tree-climbing expedition that I happened upon the majestic Salisbury Mansion and the family that lived there, the Chuzzlewits, the richest and most influential East Indians in Mumbai. I had never seen so many beautiful, distinguished people in my life. I strained to hear what they were saying.
From the tree. Be very quiet and do as I say. Come on. What are you waiting for? Come on. Where are you going? Abroad. Where's that? America. What's the candlestick for? I'm going to sell it to buy a ticket. Now listen to me. We're going to crawl past the rose bushes and turn left at the fountain. Then we'll have to make a dash for the gate. I've measured it. It'll take 6 seconds if we run fast. Okay? Oh, and be very careful of the grumpy giant.
Grumpy giant?
He eats children. So no matter what happens, we mustn't let him see us. Okay?
Okay. Won't your family worry about you?
My mother's sick. She won't notice I'm gone.
Oh, and your father?
He left.
Why?
He's a weakling.
What's that?
I don't know. That's what my grandfather calls him. We have to crawl very low now.
Okay.
Help! I'm stuck.
I'll help you.
Here, you take the candlestick. But be very careful. It's precious.
Why don't you come with me?
What?
Where?
I don't know, for adventures and stuff.
Okay, I'll come.
What about your parents?
I'm an orphan.
Like Oliver Twist?
Who's that?
I'll tell you the story if you come with me.
Vicky!
Oh no, it's a giant. Hi.
Vicky! Where are you, you naughty boy?
Run! But wait!
Who are you? Who are you? What have you got there? Show me. You little thief!
I didn't steal it!
Do you know what we do to thieves in this house? We hang them by their heels and beat them till they bleed! What? Catch that! Catch that little thief!